That's the smooth sound of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees, signaling 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of really wonderful hosts, Hank Rubichek, our producer and the show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are great storytellers. Our team goes beyond hosts and storytellers. Oh, yes, we need a production engineer and media director, and that is Tatiana Gago. And we are also welcoming Chuck Vaughn, our newest intern, to the show. Tonight, our theme is dissonance. Now, that may not sound so positive, but this is going to be a fun night. Now, some might call us misfits, but I like the word dissonance better. We're the people who are just 10 minutes ahead of everybody else and just obviously not in sync with the world around us. I have three guests tonight, Nadia Hakim, Mark Shadden, and Rich Johnston. Nadia Hakim works in the Harris County Public Health System, introducing technical innovations in healthcare. Why, yes, that's not just dissonance. That borders on disruption. So, welcome, Nadia. Can you tell us what innovations you are working on right now?
Yeah, sure thing, Mary. Thank you for having me. So, we use virtual reality to get our residents moving. And with this day and age, it comes with a lot of sitting, which has been shown to be as dangerous as smoking. So we go to a lot of the low-income neighborhoods, a lot of senior events, and we bring virtual reality just to kind of grab their attention. And once we have their attention, then we go ahead and tell them, hey, so every hour, you know, get up for about 2 minutes. You remember when you were painting in 3D in the virtual reality? That was a really good stretch. You can do something like that, so on and so forth. So it's been a lot of fun.
Sounds like a little personalized extension of we for the sedentary.
Yeah, a little more fun.
I want that when I'm in the nursing home. Did you hear that, kids? Okay, Mark Shadden lives in Denton and mostly works in Dallas for a research and consulting company called Elite Research. He does make it to Houston on a regular basis where he consults for Texas Women's University Center for research design and analysis. So, Mark, welcome to the show. I know you have a great story about being just slightly out of sync with your department in grad school, but now you're a professional statistician. What are you working on right now?
Well, the thing I love most about my job is that I'm constantly working on drastically different projects all the time. So it's hard to pick out any one, but today down at TWU in the medical center, I put on a workshop on how to use statistical analysis software.
Hmm. Great. Okay. And we have Rich Johnston back again on the show. Rich is a writer and teaches in the English and Fine Arts Department at the United States Air Force Academy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I understand your short story, Dry Sockets, was nominated this year for a Pushcart Prize. What is Dry Sockets about? And what's a pushcart prize?
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be back on the show again. Thanks for having me. The pushcart prize is awarded annually to publications from smaller, less mainstream literary journals. And Dry Sockets is a story about love found, love lost, and a one-eyed Japanese fisherman. True story, famous for his ability to open long neck beer bottles with his eye socket.
Okay, I'm in a moment of dissonance here, and it's going to take me a few seconds to recover. Where can I get a copy of this?
That particular piece was published in a journal entitled War Literature and Arts, edited by Donald Anderson, and it's freely available online.
Thank you. I have to have it. It may be my holiday gift to everybody. Well, welcome all. As I mentioned earlier, tonight's theme is about being slightly out of sync with the world around you. I quote here Henry David Thoreau, a 19th century American poet, philosopher, and journalist. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Although my guests here are from different walks of life, we all share that feeling of marching to the beat of a different drummer. And I have to tell you, I guess my beat runs in the family. My father was very much marching to the beat of a different drummer, and I will never forget when there was a portrait of Henry David Thoreau chosen as the stamp. He loved it. He went out and bought all these stamps. He filed his tax returns with these stamps. Anyway, Rich, let's get started with you. To our listeners in Radioland, let me tell you, I'm looking at a man with a very professorial appearance. Okay, he took his tie off, but he still has on the formal shirt, jacket. But in junior high, you pretended to be a drug kingpin?
Oh, that's right, Mary. You know, I should preface this by saying that one of my problems is, a problem with my sense of humor, namely that I often, and I'm getting better about this as I get older.
We're not going to ask how old you are.
but a tendency to do or say things because the idea of me doing or saying them is so funny to me because I would never do or say them. And I forget that what's funny to me because, you know, an audience of one upstairs is a sellout crowd, but not everyone in the world has bought a ticket to the show. And so it doesn't always translate very well. And this is probably the best example of this. In the seventh grade, I decided that I was going to pretend to be a cocaine dealer because, you know, the idea of me dealing, being a drug dealer was just so outrageously funny. You know, I'm not a drug dealer. I except for copious quantities of caffeine, I've never done drugs. And so this is why it was so funny. So I took a Ziploc bag and filled it full of powdered sugar or baking soda or something like that and took it to junior high school. This is seventh grade. And a spoon and some little baggies and those little ties that would come with the little baggies and went around asking my friends if they wanted to, you know, buy a spoonful of cocaine. I didn't know about ounces or grams or 8 balls or anything like that. Just, you know, would you like a spoonful of cocaine? And it had the reaction that I was going for. I mean, it shocked a lot of my friends. You know, I got a good laugh out of it. My seventh grade pre-algebra teacher, Miss Timms, however, did not get a laugh out of it when I offered to give her a spoonful of cocaine.
Oh my God, you offered the teacher some.
Well, I mean, that seemed like the logical next step in the joke. But, you know, I think the problem was is what I was only really thinking about today. I mean, this was the late 80s. I mean, the war on drugs was still in full steam. You know, there were those commercials with the egg and the frying pan. And this was a world in which you could be suspended for 5 days if you were caught with a pager in school. Mary, do doctors even have pagers anymore?
I hate to say it. I have a pager, and at my age, it is so faint, and the print is so small that I can hardly read it. They're still floating around. But I will tell you, in the 80s, in my hometown, which was a big crossover point for drugs, pagers were a big status symbol, and brides wore them on their wedding gowns. But let's go back to your story. But pagers, we get pagers.
Well, so as a result of this little prank, I took my the first of what would become many trips to the principal's office, and you know, I was an A and B student, a good kid. I hadn't done very many bad things, and you know, I think I could have been suspended for this. I don't know what the charge actually would have been, But I was not suspended. Instead, I was put into this miraculous institution called in-school suspension. Are you guys familiar with
quite,
that?
Yes.
Did they have that? Quite. I want to hear that story. Well, for me, it was a new experience that, you know, I don't even think they had to send home a letter to my parents or anything like that. But I show up the next day at school. I go into this white, this padlocked cube of light in a room near the home ec room. And there were just about 20 desks, and it was lorded over by the football coach. I guess during the day he was the ISS teacher. Your teachers would bring you your work at the beginning of the day. I would get done by 9, and then I would just have this space of 5 or 6 hours where I could think and write and create. And it was just like the most glorious thing that I had ever experienced. And, you know, the upshot of it was that I spent the rest of my junior high school career strategizing ways to get back into ISS. I would scour the disciplinary handbook like, oh, if I'm tardy to class 3 times, that'll get me 2 days in ISS. And, you know, when I needed to study or when I felt that I needed, you know, some extra intellectual space, I would do what I had to do to get back into that padlocked cube of light. That's a quotation from my favorite poet, Philip Larkin. And so like that space to, you know, to time, you know, to think and to be with your ideas, you get that in two places, in graduate school and in in-school suspension. You know, you certainly don't get that, you know, as a teacher, especially where I teach the Air Force Academy, which prides itself on, you know, on its ability to make a 30-minute PowerPoint out of something that could be said in 5 minutes. So.
Right. How long did it take the principal to realize that the usual really good student who is now offering cocaine to his algebra, pre-algebra teacher, his math teacher, it is not actually selling cocaine?
Oh, no time at all. It's not like he did the scalpel test and tasted under his tongue or anything like that. I mean, I was already crying by the time I was in the principal's office.
Nadia, have you ever tried something like that?
Oh, you're such a rebel, Rich. No, not. I've never been that bold. Like, I'm thinking back in high school, I was just worried about placing in a national dental assisting competition for Health Occupational Students of America. So, no drugs or powdered sugar for me.
I have to say, I had lived such a quiet, studious, bookworm life at home up until I reached high school that I would go to my teachers, turn in my homework, and say, I can either sit in your class and distract everybody else, or if you let me off for the hour, I can go hang out and I'll come back at the end. And then I would just go hang out with people. But I did not.
Arguably, I should have tried that more direct approach. But.
How about you, Mark? You sort of seem to lean in on that one.
Yes, so I guess I'm pretty much the black sheep of this group. I'll touch on it briefly in my story. I'll just say that.
a teaser of a story to come. Okay, well, Mark, since you have given us that teaser, that gets you the next storyteller position. So, tell us about how you wanted to get away from the madding, or as I would like to rephrase it, the maddening crowd, and how you came to know in school suspension.
As I alluded to in my response, I'm quite familiar with in school suspension. So I'm not only the first person in my family to get into a PhD program, but I'm just the first one to go to college, period. Hmm. I come from a really small town out in the middle of nowhere, Texas, called Peaster, Texas. There's a school, a post office, a Baptist church, and that's it. Not even a stoplight. So it's the kind of place where college isn't really even thought of. I mean, it's not like an ambition people think about. It's like, you know, where are you going to work when you get out? College wasn't really on my radar for that reason, but it was also not on my radar for another reason, was that I became a meth addict my junior year of high school and continued to be a meth addict for the next 7 years. So by the time I finally decided to get my act together, at about the age of 26, I applied to the University of North Texas, and I got in. But it was really scary because not only did I come from a place where nobody goes to college, so I had no resource to talk about, you know, what is college like, what am I supposed to do, how hard is it? I'd been out of school for, you know, a good 5 years or so, and also I was just recovering from a very serious addiction problem as well. So I was scared, but it was not a problem for me. I took to it like a fish to water. Like I made the president's list every single semester except for one, foreign language. I hate foreign languages. my junior year of undergrad at UNT, I also got into this really awesome program called the Ronald E. McNair Post-Baccalaureate Program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not sure if y'all are familiar with it, but mm-hmm. It's a program that gets undergrads, underrepresented people, you know, minorities, first-generation college students, low socioeconomic level. It gets them involved with some professors in their department doing research so that they can get into a PhD program and sort of help diversify academia at that level. And so I got into that, and I was doing really well. Like I said, I was a 4.0 student except for French. and I applied to graduate school, and I actually got into, like, arguably maybe a top 10, definitely top 20 PhD program in my field. And I was really excited. I felt like I was a rising star, and that lasted all of a month into my graduate program. They let me know real quick that I wasn't a fish and they weren't water anymore. And it wasn't because I was doing poorly in school either. I was performing very well. But 1 month into it, I was sitting in the office with my friend Chris, who was also in the program in my cohort, and we were working on our stats homework, and I hear across the hall this professor talking to a student in their office, and they're talking. I hear the words, you know, political violence, civil war, secessionist civil war. And I was like, oh, that's what I did my research on in undergrad. So, hey, you know what, Chris, I want to go over there and talk to him and see if I can, you know, offer some help or maybe even be a part of this research that they're doing. He says, that sounds all right. And so I go over there and I introduce myself, and I write down on a piece of paper my university email. And I say, this is my email. I've, you know, done research on what y'all are talking about. I would love to be involved in whatever y'all are doing. And then I leave. I go back and I sit in the office, and then I hear the professor's door close and the student walk off, and then the professor walks in and she closes the door behind her. And she turns around and she is volcanic red, y'all. I mean, just ready to explode. And she did. She is yelling at me. She is literally pointing her finger, not at me, but in my forehead, and yelling at me, how dare you? I can't believe you just did that in front of me. How dare you hit on an undergrad in front of me? And I'm just like, wait, is that how she thinks sliding into the DMs works? Like, you use your university email? Like, I think it's a little more suave than that, actually. But I wasn't about to say that because she looked really mad. So I was just apologizing. I'm really sorry. I didn't understand. I'm new here. I don't know how this works. But that was just one of the first incidents. I locked myself out of my office one time, so I climbed the side of the building to get in instead of calling. So they called security on me. Yeah, they didn't like that. I wore a baseball cap to a conference. They didn't like that. And my favorite is that I went to a local, they were like raising money for like a pet adoption agency, and they had it at the local minor league baseball field. And, you know, I don't have the guts to like go streaking across a major league baseball field, but if I've had a few beers, I might run across a minor league one day. I did. And so I just kept doing these things. Like, I was doing well in the program. It's just they didn't like who I was as a person. And I was doing so well in the program, in fact, that I got one of the most prestigious fellowships that a graduate student can get in the United States, the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship.
Wow. Yes.
And for people that don't know what that is, they give out 20 of them per field. So basically 20 political science PhD students that year in all of the United States got this. And it's about $250,000. And so basically I was like a top 20 in my field of graduate students, right? And so there's no arguing that I wasn't doing well in the program, but they just didn't like me. And so 30 year rolls around, it's time to do comps. And for what I was doing in political science, I specialized in statistical methodology, hence statistician now. But when you do that, you have to do a little bit extra. There's more tests that you have to take, but you get to choose topics because statistics is a broad category. And so I go to them, I tell them, okay, these are the two topics I want you to test me on. They say, okay, Testing day rolls around. I go in, they're the wrong topics. But I'm like, okay, I'm just going to give it a try anyway. It'll be good practice. But I know I'm not going to do well. So I do it, and I go to them the next day, and I say, hey, y'all gave me the wrong topics. You need to make this right. And they're like, oh, you're right. Yeah, we did give you the wrong topics. Reschedule in a couple weeks, do it again. So they do that, reschedule a couple weeks. I go back in, again, wrong topics.
Whoa.
This time I'm like, okay, you know, one data point's a point, two data points is a line, so we're getting a pattern here. So I go to them the next day, and I say, hey, y'all did it to me again. What's the deal? And they said, well, you didn't take the test, so it doesn't matter. You're just going to have to leave. And I'm like, really? I'm just going to have to leave? Like, I have the NSF fellowship. Like, it doesn't even cost you anything for me to be here. And they would never say it, but I knew it was because they just didn't like who I was as a person. And they probably had issues with the kind of research I want to do, too, but that's another story. But I was obviously doing well at what I did. So I thought about fighting it. I looked into getting like a lawyer or whatever. But, you know, with universities, they're the judge, jury, executioner. There's nothing you can do. So I just wore myself out after a couple weeks. And then eventually I just had this deep sigh and had this thought. It's like, why am I trying so hard to be a part of this group that just doesn't want me to be there? And so I just gave up. And so my, you know, 5 or 6 year plan of what I wanted to do with my life. Like, this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an academic and study human rights and teach at university. I just had to give it up. And I did, and it still stings. And, you know, even to this day, I still have friends who know that story and family. They'll ask me at like Thanksgiving, it's like, oh, you ever think about going back, just go to a different program? Mm-hmm. And I just try to change the subject. But if they push me a little bit, I'll tell them, you know, I never did it because I wanted to be called Dr. Shadden, and I never did it because I wanted that PhD diploma to hang over my desk at work and so that when people walk in, they see, oh, there's that PhD guy, you know. I did all of that because I wanted to see what I was made of. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I wanted to prove something to myself. And I felt like I got all I needed out of it. You know, I don't even hang up my diplomas in like over a fireplace. They're in my closet at home. Because it's the one place where I'm the only person that goes in there, you know? And so I'm glad of what I did. I don't feel any need to go back. And what I really want people to take away from my story is that, you know, there's a lot of problems with our education system. And people think that, you know, you meet someone who's got a PhD, you automatically assume that's a good measure of like, oh, they must be one of the smartest people ever. It may be. What is true is they're hardworking and dedicated. That is for certain. Mm-hmm. But maybe next time you meet somebody that says they have a PhD, just think to yourself, they're probably afraid to go streaking across a baseball
field. That was a very moving story and a marvelous way to conclude it,
Thank you. I have to say.
I think you're a very optimistic person, and I really appreciate that.
I try to be.
It's a dissonant life. Well, Nadia, we've heard about dissonance with fellow students, but I think you have a story of, let's say, an improv situation that kind of didn't go down the way it was supposed to.
So this was actually after grad school, but it did involve a couple of friends from grad school. I was fresh out of grad school and going through a really terrible breakup. I had been in a long distance relationship the whole time I was at Syracuse University, so it was like 2.5 years, and finally moved back to Houston. And of course, we're like, oh, we're finally in the same zip code. It only makes sense that we move in together, right? So we move in together, and then we end up breaking up a month afterwards because it turns out the only way we could put up with each other was if we only had to see each other a weekend every 3 to 4 weeks. So going through this terrible breakup, and I'm in D.C. doing some work, and I have a couple of friends from grad school, Mike and Tammy, and they're giving me kind of a pep talk. They're like, Nads, you know, we're going to take you out. I'm like, yeah, we're going to go out. And they're like, no, and we're going to have a good time. I'm like, yeah. Have a good time. And they're like, no, and you know what, we're gonna get smashed, we are gonna tear it up, we're gonna get smashed. I'm like, yeah, we're gonna get smashed. And then they're like, and you know what, we're gonna find you someone and you're gonna smash. And I was like, a really tiny Hulk. And I was like, Nadia, smash. So we go out and we're having a good time. Like, we go out, check, we're having a good time, check, and We're throwing them back. We're getting smashed. Check, check. So it comes to that point of the night where you have so much in you that you just want to go out and dance, right? So we had gone to all these bars and we just really want to dance. So let's go to a gay club, right? Like, that's fail-proof, right? They're gonna have amazing music. So we go to a gay club and yeah, the music is pumping. It's a really great time. And all of these people, they're flocking towards Tammy, and understandably so. She's gorgeous. She's got this really exotic look to her. She's got short hair, really interesting tattoos, just really, really fascinating person inside and out. And the good thing to know about Tammy is that she is a fantastic wing woman, a great ally, and she's also very heterosexual. So where everyone, like I said, everyone's flocking towards all these gay men are like, oh my goodness, you're so beautiful. Can I buy you a drink? Take shots with us. And apparently there's got to be a graph somewhere that shows like the correlation between how attractive of a woman you are and how badly gay men want to drink with you. So Mike and I are like, well, Tammy, us ugly folk, we've already bought our drinks. So we're going to go and hit up the dance floor. And she's like, all right, yeah, sure thing. I'll catch up with you guys. We're like, all right, cool. So we'll see you. So we hit the dance floor and we're having a good time, and a few minutes go by and Tammy Hurdley comes over and she's like, hey, so there's this girl who's approached me and she's really persistent. And I'm like, okay, well, is she buying you a drink? Well, yeah, she just left to go get me a drink. Well, Tammy, we are fresh out of grad school. We're broke as a joke. We do not turn away free drinks. No. She's like, no, absolutely we do not. But what am I going to say? What am I going to do? I'm like, Tammy, I got you. When she comes back, you give me a signal, and I'll just go over and I'll pretend to be your girlfriend. Easy as pie, right? So, when I recall the story, Tammy was like, yeah, of course, you're a genius, Nads. Yeah, like, why didn't I think of that? When Tammy recalls the story, it's, oh my goodness, you're an idiot. Yeah, right. So, she goes back to the other side of the club, the land of free drinks, and Mike and I get back to dancing. And the girl comes back and she hands Tammy the drink. And then she looks over to where we're at. And then she raises both eyebrows. And I'm looking at her and I'm like, shoot, was that the signal? Oh, we didn't decide on a signal. Oh, man, was that the signal? Oh, that's the signal, right? And I'm thinking all this in my head, but Mike is kind of thinking things out loud. He's like, was that the signal? Two eyebrows, right? Two eyebrows. The lesbians are coming. The lesbians are coming by sea. Like, he's like a gay, panicked Paul Revere. And I'm like, all right. So there's a general consensus that was the signal. So I'm just going to go strut my way over there, you know, coolly as you do in the club. And as I'm walking over there, I'm going through all these different scenarios in my head. I'm like, all right, well, what do I do when I get there? Okay, well, maybe I'll just, I'll get there and I'll slide my arm around Tammy and I'll take a sip of her drink. No, that's a little too brutal. She was the one who bought her the drink. You know, this is just to get her out of her hair, right? So, okay, well, how about, what are other couple-y things you can do? Okay, well, maybe I'll just brush Tammy's hair away from her face. Well, Tammy doesn't really have hair, so what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I don't know why I had so much time to think about all this. There was hardly anybody in that club. So I finally get there, and I slide my arm around Tammy, and then I throw everything I thought of out the window, and I kiss her square in the mouth. And we freeze there for a minute, and the girl is looking at the both of us back and forth, and finally just throws her hands in a huff and just, whatever. And she storms off. And I'm pulling away. I'm like, my work here is done. I've got a really smug look on my face. And I'm getting ready to say, you're welcome. But before I can even do that, Tammy says, I just told her I was straight. Oh. Yeah, thanks, Nads. Thanks. Yeah, that was it.
That's a great story. I actually have to tell you, I heard you tell that story at the Moth, and I've told a few people that story. I don't do it as well as you, obviously. Not.
Shucks.
When I was much younger, I lived in New York, and I had gone from this life where I knew there were gay people. There was this cousin of mine that I thought was gay, but he never said he was gay. He always claimed to have girlfriends. So So let's just say when you come from Rio Grande City, your gaydar might not be that good. And I went to England for 3 years, and then I went to San Francisco, where all the gay men stay in one quarter, and all the gay women stay in another quarter, and then all the straight people are in another area, and you don't mix. So I got to New York, and I actually lived in the apartments above the Health and Racket Club that you see all the time in Seinfeld. It's kind of exciting. And there was a bar right down and below me, and I would wait till the dinner crowd left, and I would go there. And I didn't know that maybe after 10 there were a lot of gay people there, but there were a lot of straight people there. Anyway, I started dating this guy. He was kind of a pretty-looking boy, blonde. And I took him in there with me, and now I realize this other guy is trying to pick him up. So this other guy comes up and keeps offering him a drink. I do not know what's going on. And I'm just sitting there saying, well, I'm here. You could buy me a drink, too. And this three-way conversation is going on. The two men are getting very confused, perplexed, and a little frustrated with me. Like, don't you get it, lady? Like, the guy I'm on the date with is like, would you please get me out of here? And the other guy is like, would you please get out of here? And I'm like, where's my drink? But I've progressed since then. Okay, I know we have some more romance gone wrong to address, but let's go to station identification. We are here on So What's Your Story? Broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, or live streaming from kpft.org. Also from the space station, they can get us. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. So, Tatiana, how else can people access our show?
Yes, ma'am. First, let me put on my social media hat on and say something about that. If you don't have a radio, that's absolutely no excuse for missing it, because in addition to our live audio streaming on kpft.org, we are also on Facebook Live. Although we don't have it today, we normally do it every week. But it's on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And you can actually watch us all tell our stories.
Tatiana, I've heard a rumor that, yes, we are the only live storytelling venue on radio, but there are other storytelling venues in town. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. While we are the only live storytelling radio show in Houston, there definitely are some other important storytelling venues in and around town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located on 1500 Sunset. You can go on their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under Radio Program. Uh-huh. Also, breaking news, Houston Storytellers Guild is holding a celebration this Saturday, November 17th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Black Lab. No charge.
Ah, that's the place to be on Saturday. Now, those old podcasts, I have to tell you, they are a treasure trove, and I go back there all the time. It's a favorite site of mine.
Yes, and you can find all kinds of stories there. Funny, sad, fantasy, and fairy tale, told and retold. You can also tell us what you think about our show or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And we absolutely promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with your friends. And oh yes, we'd love it if you like us when you leave. And don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live. It's the second Tuesday of the month. And last night was a November show. The next one will be December 11th, and the theme is instincts. What does your sixth sense tell you about this one? Well, go for it, storytellers.
And what's happening next Wednesday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT 90.1? Do we have somebody here in the studio?
We have the remarkable Eric Heen here. He will be hosting next week. You got anything to say, Eric?
Yeah, we got a good show brewing next week. It's going to have a little bit of a Greek flavor. Going to look at some old Greek fables and myths, and we're going to kind of bring them up to the present, so it'll be interesting.
That's fantastic. I have to tell you, I heard a prospective graduate student telling us today that she grew up in a rural area of Colorado, and when her fourth grade teacher started teaching the class about Greek mythology, she had to stop because she was teaching the children black magic. Okay, I love folklore, so I will definitely be tuned in. Now, though, let's get back to our show here in the present. I just mentioned that we were going to hear some more stories of romantic dissonance. Rich, you up for this?
I can tell you several stories about romantic dissonance. The one that you just told, Mary, about kind of being the third wheel in that situation.
Yeah, right.
really, I'm going to read a story in which I mention being a third wheel. It was a role that I got really used to in life, to the point where I think that either in a previous life or in a future life, I'm going to be reincarnated as a tricycle or something like that. So the story that I'm going to tell is entitled Theory of Natural Selection. And it was my first published story and still one of my favorites. And I think it'll go along with these stories nicely. 1. You didn't tell me it was a nude beach. All the beaches here are nude beaches, Ilza said, as if that explained everything. It was only 10 in the morning, but the beach was crowded with limbs. I've never been to a nude beach, I said. You don't have them in the Carolinas? Ilza asked, removing her top. Petrus, her boyfriend, had already stripped. I tried not to look. I don't think so, I said. Petrus grabbed our things and lugged them down to the beach. Ilza removed her jeans. Is it all right if I wear my swimming trunks? I asked. Ilza gave me a sidelong glance and laughed. Only if you want people to think you're, how do you say in English, is virtuous. I didn't need a dictionary. 2. Earlier that morning, Ilza had told me that, for my last day in Latvia, she wanted to take me to the beach. There was a place, she said, where the Gulf of Riga meets the Baltic Sea and the waves intersect at right angles. We cleared the dishes and packed a basket with bread, cheese, and fruit from her parents' orchard. She added a bottle of wine and some cups. I was, of course, if you haven't guessed by now, in love with Ilza. She was the most beautiful woman I had ever known. She was also smart as a blade. We had met in England, where I was studying evolutionary biology, and she was doing a fellowship in European law. Our friendship was struck the night at the King's Arms. She told me about her problems with her boyfriend. Apparently, I was the first man who didn't attempt to seduce her afterwards. I guess I'm good about that sort of thing. At the end of Trinity term, Ilza invited me to speak a week in Latvia. 3. This is the way to the beach. Ilza had turned off the highway onto a straight dirt road. On either side were the junked remains of communist-era cars. No, Ilza laughed. This is where Petrus lives. I paused. Petrus is coming with us? Yes, she said. He didn't have to work today. I didn't know he had a job, I said. Ilza had often complained about Petrus's lack of motivation. Once when I asked her what he did for a living, she replied, he collects motorcycles. One night, at the King's Arms, Ilza had started crying, taken my hands and told me about his affair with a high school student. Why do you stay with him, Ilza? Because he loves me. He doesn't deserve you, I said. You can do better. Find someone better. Ilza shook her head. Ilza, he's sitting right here. I wanted to say that, but never did. Ilza and Petrus had met me at the airport when I arrived and taken me to dinner. We tried various local dishes. Every time I said something to Ilza, Petrus grunted. That was apparently Ilza's order to translate. 4. The day went downhill fast. At Petrus's house, I learned we'd be traveling the rest of the way to the beach by motorcycle. I also learned I'd be riding behind Petrus. Petrus had taught Ilza how to ride, but she didn't feel comfortable having someone ride behind her yet. At least, that's what she said to me. The ride to the beach lasted 30 minutes. It felt like forever. Petrus took the lead. I didn't like the idea of Ilza watching me cling to her boyfriend. I bet I look like a snail on a rock. 5. I had played the third wheel many times, and over the years I have come to embrace the role, but playing it on a nude beach, that was a new one. After we set our things down, a question arose. Where exactly did my towel go? As Petrus rubbed tanning lotion onto Ilza's back, I ran through all the possible towel combinations in my head, but none of them seemed right. On the one hand, I was her guest. On the other hand, they were a naked couple. Petrus had probably been hoping I'd fall off his bike. So I asked Ilza if I could go for a walk and look at the dunes. Of course, Ilza said, and Petrus grunted. 6. Latvia's Baltic coastline is almost completely undeveloped except for a few fishing villages and some dilapidated concrete resorts for Communist Party officials. A forest of black pines begins right at the edge of 60-foot dunes. I had long passed all the naked people when the sound of laughter spilled from the pines. Suddenly, a naked woman burst from the trees. She tumbled down the dune, scrambled to her feet, and ran laughing toward the water. Then a naked man, even larger than Petrus, burst from the trees. The woman screamed and began running in lopsided circles. It was a love chase like the ones you see on antique vases. After the woman spotted me, she steered toward me and crouched behind me, laughing. Her lover came after her. He stood right in front of me, smiling and making ape-like noises. It was impossible not to notice his state of semi-arousal. Then the woman made a run for it. She actually pushed off of me, off of my back, and ran down the beach. She made it about 20 yards before her lover tackled her. And that's when they started having sex. 7. 2 realizations came to me then. You could call them epiphanies, the chastening kind. The first concerned the options my last day in Latvia had presented me. I could remain standing there like a piece of equipment in some erotic obstacle course, or I could rejoin Ilza and Petrus and try to find the right place for my damn towel. I think the second realization was triggered by something I had seen the previous summer on a trip to the Galapagos. A blue-footed booby with pale green feet, weakly spreading its wings to the sky long after mating season had ended. Our two guides had chuckled. Now, watching the sex actually happening right in front of me on the hard sand, I was certain that this was what natural selection must actually feel like.
That's a wonderful story. You've had us laughing and in tears, but it's also very moving. Mm. It's difficult. I played third wheel sometimes, and then when I had a romance, the very odd thing is that it seemed as though for 10 or 15 years, my romances were always long distance.
No.
And I actually sought out therapy. Does nobody want to be close to me? Romance is hard.
Yeah.
Very hard. Mm-hmm. But Rich, that was really wonderful written, and our readers, listeners actually, find it to read again?
Well, that story was published by Hobart, which is an online literary magazine. Their website is www.hobartpulp.com. And if you were to Google Theory Natural Selection Hobart, you'd find it pretty easily.
Hmm. You have any other ongoing writing projects you can tell us about?
Sure. I mean, just a couple. I've been working on a collection of stories called God Knows How Many, which is about a kind of comically absurd string of bad online, or what I like to call internet facilitated dates from my 30s. For example, the woman I took to dinner who kept kind of scratching her ankle or scratching her calf, and then started complaining that her ankle bracelet was chafing her. And like, well, this is really promising. Mom, Dad, I've met someone, but you're going to have to come out to meet her because she can't leave the state. Stories like that. And then actually working on a play right now called So Far Gone, about two couples who attempt to simultaneously disconnect from a world that seems to be going to hell in a handbasket real quick, but also reconnect with each other by going off the grid for 2 days in the mountains. But they find it difficult both reconnecting with each other and disconnecting from the world because one couple is expecting the first child and the other couple, they are avowed antinatalists who are ethically, morally, and philosophically opposed to human procreation.
Is this anything like Promises, Promises?
I don't know that work.
Maybe not quite, but it's two couples who go off together and find connection and dissonance, but along slightly different themes. I think it's sexual attractions to the wrong person. But I will be waiting for your play. So I'd like to do something fun here. I'd like to do a little round robin about travel and maybe a little short dissonant travel story. And Nadia, I'm going to start with you. Just travel is something that happened.
Oh, geez. Okay, so my grandmother's sister is the only one of her siblings who didn't make it all the way to the States from the Philippines, so she ended up in Australia. And there was this point where I was visiting her for a couple of weeks every year for like 3 or 4 years. And there was this one time I was there with my sister and my mom. And we had planned out this day, all right, we're going to go to the Blue Mountains in Katoomba. Fun fact, the reason why they're called the Blue Mountains is because of the eucalyptus that grows on there. So the vapor that comes off of that, it actually gives the appearance that the mountains are blue. So we took the train out of Sydney. We went on a bus, and we finally get to Katoomba. And we find the little entryway what do you call those things? The air trams?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the cable cars, yeah?
Monorail.
So yeah. So except it's the one that hangs off of, and it goes through the mountains, through the air. So we get there, and we bought tickets, and we're like, oh, this will be fun. So we're standing in line, and as we're waiting, this giant motor coach comes by and just unpacks all these tourists from Hong Kong. They're all these middle-aged tourists from Hong Kong, and they just spill out of this motor coach. And I'm like, okay, all right. So we're still waiting for the air tram, and this one woman with this giant camera and this huge lens, she's pointing her camera at something in my direction, and she's right in my face. So I move my head back, and she moves her camera with me. So I move it forward, and she moves it again with me, and I like try dodging it, but she keeps following me, and she starts taking all these pictures of me. I'm like, oh, this is weird. And I just kind of smile at her, bewildered, and as soon as I smiled at her, she was like, ah! And then she comes under my arm, and she asks one of her friends to take a picture of us. So they start taking pictures, and then more people start coming towards me, and they're taking pictures, and they're posing with me, and they've got their tablets out, and they're taking pictures with their tablets and their cameras, and it's this motor coach full of Hong Kong tourists from Hong Kong just taking pictures with me. And then I like look over at my sister, who's just as confused as I am, and I'm like, oh, sister. And they're like, oh, sister, you know, so they get her in, and they start taking pictures of her and me, and it's this whole ordeal. And I was like, wow, this is very, very strange. And like to this day, I think, like, I wonder if I'm on some mantles in Hong Kong, you know. And they were asking for photos, and this whole ordeal lasted for like 6-7 minutes, and which is a lifetime in taking photos, because it only takes you what, half a second to take a photo. But the air tram finally comes, and my mom and sister get on, and before I hop on, I'm like, oh, by the way, I'm Demi Moore. See you guys. And then I head off. So haven't run into them ever since. But
There's a lot of pictures of you in Hong Kong.
Oh, yep.
And you made a lot of people very happy.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Rich, how about you?
Oh, gosh. I wish Japan. I wish I had time to tell about the one-eyed Japanese fisherman who could open beer bottles with, and who would open your beer bottle with his eye socket if you bought him a beer too. I don't have time to tell that story.
Dissonance, folks. Dissonance.
I guess you'll have to read it. But, one other story about just the vagaries of travel comes to mind. So in Japan, I was kicked out of the health club that I belonged to for about a month and wasn't allowed to come back until I'd gotten a doctor's note. And the reason was, well, it was discovered by a locker room attendant in the bathroom that I had a case of athlete's foot, a pretty bad case of athlete's foot. And I was more or less like physically manhandled and forced out. And I could never really understand this. It took me a while to understand it. It basically boils down to this. I mean, in the United States, I mean, if you think about it, every athlete's foot commercial that you've ever seen on television, like, you have to be doing everything right to get athlete's foot. You have to be the guy who goes to the gym, plays basketball for 3 hours, and then you come into the locker room, you take off your shoes, your feet are on fire, and John Madden comes in and blows out the flames with a fire extinguisher. I mean, so if you get athlete's foot, like, yes, I got athlete's foot. I'm so awesome. In Japan, the word for athlete's foot is Mizumushi, I believe that's right. But the characters, what it really literally means is something like triple swamp wet moisture, or something like that.
Man.
And it's just this. I mean, I remember going into pharmacies with my electronic dictionary asking for Mizumushi Cream, athlete's foot cream, and the pharmacist actually kind of like stepping back as though I had,
athlete's foot.
Horrible communicable disease, leprosy or something.
No athlete there in the picture. All right. Well, I'll tell you my little short story. I think I was about 21, and I was traveling in Italy, and I needed to buy sanitary napkins. Now, my family has always been very traditionally shy and withdrawn about buying this kind of equipment. In fact, I went on this scholarship to study in England, and my mother packed a suitcase with a 3-year supply of sanitary napkins and said to me, "You don't want to have to go to a drugstore and be seen buying these." So when I had to go into this drugstore in Rome and buy them, this was very embarrassing. And so I'm waiting until everybody leaves, and I can kind of go up and whisper to the clerk, "Sanitary napkins." And I know not to say Kotex, because that's a brand name, and why would I expect that to be the name in Italy? So I go up and I whisper, "Sanitary napkins." She doesn't understand a thing. And now she starts bringing her coworkers over. Well, now my face is fully red. The sweat's coming down. I'm going through these moments of I think I'm going to faint. I think my heart's going to burst out. And I just keep saying, "Sanitary napkins." And more people are coming. Well, now customers are in the store. And the most handsome man walks up and says, "I speak English. I can help." And I look at him and I'm just like, "Oh my God." And I just close my eyes and say, "Sanitary napkins." And the word goes back and forth between the two of us a few times just to make it even worse. And then he says, "Ah! Kotex!" And now everybody knows what I need. Oh, God, I think I could have just gone into the floor about that time.
Great story.
Hey, Nadia, Rich, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being here and for sharing some really wonderful stories with us and with our fans in Radioland. I'd like to give each of you a chance to say goodnight to somebody special in Radioland, and we're going to go in alphabetical order. So we're going to start with Mark.
Hey, Chase and Amanda, I know you're listening right now, and you're the only reason I'm doing this, because you know this is my nightmare, but I love you both.
Thank you, Chase and Amanda, for making this happen for us. Okay, Nadia.
Ooh, I'm gonna have to sneak a couple people in there. So thanks to my parents and my sister for always providing me with stories and just this amazing thing called life. And then special thanks to my partner, Shannon, for putting up with me and for taking care of the dogs tonight. So I love you.
And you, Rich?
A big thanks to my family who give me a lot of the material for my story. So my mom, my dad, my stepmom, my stepdad, my sisters, Julie and Harriet. I'd also thank my partner. I'm no longer a third wheel. I'm a bicycle now. But she adamantly refused to let me name her on the radio, but she knows who she is, and I love her very much.
That's wonderful. Well, I have a couple of minutes, so I'm going to say goodnight to my cats. And Prue, I'm really sorry I ran out this morning without feeding you. It was an entire mistake. I was two blocks down the road and late, but I'm going to bring you lots of food tonight. So, well, everybody out there, don't you dare move, because we have a new and exciting show following us. Coming up next, you'll be loving the very cool, the very new Flash Gordon Parks here on KPFT. Now make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Can you, my darling, can you picture this? Dream if you can, courtyard, an ocean of violets in bloom.
The Historic Heights Theater on 19th Street hosts a wide variety of concerts and special events. Upcoming concerts include Latino punk pioneer Alejandro Escovedo on Sunday, January 6th, Joan Osborne singing the songs of Bob Dylan on Friday, February 7th, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame guitar greats Dave Mason and Steve Cropper's Rock and Soul Review on Friday, March 1st, and a Bowie celebration featuring the David Bowie Alumni Tour on Wednesday, March 20th. For more information or to get tickets, visit theheightstheater.com. This is KPFT Houston.
Flash Gordon Parks.